me just share a few statistics. I don't want to burden you with a lot of numbers, but just to give some profile of where we're at on some of these statistics around inequality in the early 21st century. One of the striking changes that has taken place between the 1960s and the early 21st century, late 20th century even, was the change in family structures in many of these now largely poor, largely segregated neighborhoods. In 1970, the number of single-parent families in the U.S. was 3.8 million. In 1990, that number had almost tripled to 9.7 million. One in four children are born to an unmarried mother, many of whom are teenagers. Another 40% of children under 18 experience parental breakup. That's national. That figure then becomes compounded in poor neighborhoods, in racially segregated neighborhoods, which, as William Julius Wilson, the noted sociologist, suggests, are contexts of concentrated poverty. Concentrated in the sense that in these neighborhoods, you have people living together in high density situations most often, who basically share the same essential profile as everybody else they see. Single parent headed household, underemployed, undereducated, over-incarcerated. There's no opportunity for that, or little opportunity for that kind of interaction and exchange across social boundaries that my parents grew up with in segregated Indianapolis, where middle class and upper class African Americans were living side by side, attending church side by side with underclass and lower working class African Americans. And so you don't have that sort of exchange going on. And so that the situation hardens and escalates. About 7% of the U.S. population in 2010 made up the poorest of the poor, which was defined as 50% below the poverty line. So the poverty line for a single person is around almost $12,000 for a single person. For a family of four, it's about $24,000. So 50% of that, for a single individual, that means about $5,500 a year. For a family of four, $12,000 a year. And so 6.7% of the U.S. population was living at that level in 2010. So those living below the poverty line were double that, about 15%. Today, nearly a fourth of the children under age 18 in our country live with a single mother family. Couple more stats. Unemployment rates, disparities in employment prospects. African American unemployment in 2010 was 16%, as compared with white unemployment, which is half that, 8%. Keep in mind, as you know about unemployment figures, that only counts the people who are actively seeking. So if you're not going out, filling out applications, if you're not on unemployment, if you're not sort of in the system some sort of way, you're not even counting. So the actual people, the actual percentage of persons that are working are far smaller than that particular, than any of these official unemployment statistics suggest. Back to the separation piece again. Even now in the U.S., the typical African-American student attends a school where only 29, public school, where only 29% of his or her fellow students are white. That means most African-American students are in schools that are at least about 70% African-American. And there are increasingly an increasingly large number of African American students that are attending schools that are probably 100% African American. 12% of black students in the South, nearly a quarter of students in Alabama, attend schools that are essentially 1% or less anything other than African American population. There's a term now that's being used for these type of schools. The term is apartheid schools. So, separate, as the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court ruling concluded, separate is inherently unequal. We've got severe separation still in our societies. You're here in the Pittsburgh area. We're all here in the Pittsburgh area. I'm new to Pittsburgh, 2 years. I'm learning the Pittsburgh area. One of the things that I've been told over and over again about Pittsburgh is that it's an extremely segregated city. You can let me know whether those reports are correct. It seems to me that, and it may not necessarily be premised on race. It seems to be premised to a great extent on sort of neighborhood identities and so forth. But then that translates into race often. That translates into class. So we still have all these separations. Separate, unequal. There's a book written in 2003 by a sociologist named Andrew Hacker. And he builds on that conclusion from the Kerner Commission. The title of his book is Two Nations, Black, White, Separate, Hostile, and Unequal. So he adds an adjective to this. Not only separate and unequal, but that separation and that inequality then sort of leads to hostilities. But when we have this kind of severe separation between races, between classes, when we have these severe disparities and inequalities, another statistic for you, I mean, the disparity between CEO compensation and the average worker compensation. In the 1960s, it was about 20-1. Currently, it's about almost 300-1. That there's some severe disparities that are escalating and compounding based upon separations, based upon public policies, based upon structures and systems that are not building community, not bringing people together, but driving people apart, decimating community structures. And we have to take those systems and structures and policies and practices very, very seriously. Now, the hostilities, we don't, obviously, we're living in a 2 to 3 year stretch where those hostilities become far more public, far more pronounced. We're looking at headlines, we're looking at news programs, news stories, day after day after day, where we're seeing these clashes, these collisions between these separate worlds. We may pretend that we can sort of separate out people that we don't necessarily want to be in community with, and somehow that out of sight and out of mind means that there are no consequences, that it doesn't matter. We can live in our silos, others live in their silos, and never do the worlds meet, but that is really not the way things are in our world, obviously. We can pretend that there are no consequences to these separations, but the reality is that these things will inevitably collide in all sorts of ways. We can't pretend it isn't real. We have to take it seriously because there are no hiding places. We all share this very, very small world together. So not only the separations and the divisions that exist within our country, but within our world, there are no hiding places from these things. We have to figure out how to build community across all of these separations and all these divisions. That's what we're left with. Or else we just move from hostility to hostility. We move closer to what the political philosopher Thomas Hobbes called every man against every man. We don't really have a choice. We have to figure this thing out. And so it's certainly not acceptable to just maintain policies, for example, like the policies that have contributed to mass incarceration within the last few decades, and since the Richard Nixon administration, the war on drugs, then leads to very sort of unequal sentencing. And then that leads to an enormous, and I think, Bobby, you told me, you and Amy told me that, didn't you do some reading of Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow here? So excellent accounting of that process, the school-to-prison pipeline, the kind of outcomes from policies that target a specific kind of illegality. Not just drug use, but a specific drug use, crack cocaine, predominantly used by the poor. Stiffer, harsher sentences for that particular crime, as opposed to the crime, the sentencing for powder cocaine, more expensive product used by people with more money. They get far less time for doing that drug than the poor get for doing crack cocaine. There are numbers of poor persons who are serving life sentences for selling crack cocaine. Nonviolent offenses, no violence involved, no guns, just selling crack cocaine, and they're doing a life sentence. It makes no sense. And this is something that is even more startling when you look at the figures. When you look at the number of African Americans that have, African Americans make up just over 10% of the U.S. population, but they make up more than 50% of the American prison population. African-American youth are 44%, or roughly almost 50%, more likely to be arrested, to have that offense then taken to trial, and generally get much stiffer sentences for the crimes that they commit when compared with non-African Americans committing the same crime. That kind of a system just can't, it's unsustainable. We just simply cannot continue to have policies such as that target the poor, that target people of color in ways that decimate their communities and their prospects, and that's exactly what's happened. Once you get a felony on your record, in many states, you cannot vote. You always have to fill out that, you have to check off that box on the job application. Have you ever been convicted of a felony? And it's been demonstrated quite clearly that when that box is checked, your chances of getting a job with that particular employer are diminished. Families are broken up. I was just talking with my friend here who's on the front lines of some of this, and he was just talking about some of the challenges that the clients that he works with in the juvenile justice system, the challenges just getting the families to be able to visit their loved one who's incarcerated because of locations and so forth. Families are broken up. Children then grow up in situations where they're surrounded by incarcerated family members. It's a compounding situation. And then on top of this, then you get policing practices that are clearly not, in many instances, what we would want to see in the interest of simply protecting law. There's obviously other things going on in many of these instances that result in the hostility levels between communities and our police departments escalating to very, very troubling levels. All these young, unarmed African-American men and increasingly women. This, I guess it was just yesterday, there was a major protest at one of the Democratic presidential candidates' forums out in Arizona. Bernie Sanders and McDonnell, I guess the former governor of Maryland or Virginia?
O'Malley.
We're both at this session in Arizona that was totally disrupted by protesters who were protesting the increased frequency of African-American women who were being killed by police. So, I mean, we heard all the reports about the African-American, unarmed African-American men being killed by police, targeted for frisk and search and stop and seizure and all the rest. Policies that are just unworkable, unsustainable. The collisions are going to continue unless we can figure this thing out. Now, let me just conclude by just saying a couple things about how to think about the future. And I know Jim's going to come in and some others are coming in next week and talk into those parts of the conversation more systematically. But I'd like us to sort of consider or reconsider that well-known passage in Luke 12, the Samaritan who passes the man who's laying by the side of the road, who's been robbed and mugged and so forth. And you know the story of several people pass by and do nothing to help, and finally this Samaritan, this sort of outsider, passes and stops, nurses the man's wounds, puts him on his horse, takes him to an inn, and has the innkeeper get the man a room and leaves money to make sure that the man's needs are met, and indicates that if there's more that needs to be done, he'll take care of it on his way back. Now, there's all sorts of wonderful, wonderful teachings, obviously, that we come away from that passage with, but the one thing I want to focus on is simply the fact that the first thing that happened in that instance was that the Samaritan man attended to the wounds. He stopped the bleeding. You know, a lot of times, in a lot of conversations that I'm part of, that you're part of, we're talking about reconciliation. We're talking about forgiveness and healing. But we're not attending to the bleeding first. I want to suggest that the first thing that we have to do is to stop the bleeding. It's hard to talk about healing of relationships until we first stop the bleeding, which means we've got to attend to public policies, to practices, social practices that are contributing to the bleeding. The carnage from mass incarceration, it is enormous. If you have not read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, or other accounts of the problem in our country of mass incarceration, I would encourage you to do so. The implications of that particular, and former President Bill Clinton came out just this past week and publicly acknowledged that he is at fault for contributing to the problem with a policy that he signed off on during his presidential administration. I think it was the three strikes law that's contributed to the problem. Three strikes and then your sentencing goes way, way. There's more acknowledgement, more public acknowledgement that this is an unworkable policy. President Obama, as you know, I mean, first of all, the 2010 Fair Sentencing Act that he signed into law, which addresses this issue of unequal sentencing between powder cocaine, crack cocaine, and other sort of unfair sentencing practices. The last couple of years, he's been very intentional and very systematic about granting clemency, as he just did in the past couple of weeks, to nonviolent offenders. So I think there were about almost 50 nonviolent offenders that were granted clemency by President Obama just in the last 2 weeks, and there have been dozens in months prior to that. There's a public acknowledgement. And President Obama's come kind of slow on this issue, quite frankly, because this thing has been hemorrhaging. The bleeding has been happening throughout his administration, throughout George W. Bush, throughout President Bill Clinton, all the way back to Richard Nixon. This thing has been hemorrhaging for decades. And so that's one place I think we need to really give some attention, some very systematic attention. Support all the efforts being made by our public officials to stop that bleeding, to get rid of this mass incarceration policy, to try to figure out ways to address issues of delinquency and crime and social despair that do not sort of begin and end with the criminal justice system. We simply can't do it. I was watching, just a quick aside, I was watching a documentary yesterday on China. And apparently they've got, you know, in Chinese society, they have these sort of reprogramming camps or something. I mean, when people aren't thinking correctly, they have these ways they try to reprogram your thinking. But which is kind of a harsh way of saying, and maybe an accurate way of saying, that they're really working on people's attitudes and behaviors when they sense something is amiss. And so there was this whole camp that they had for delinquent youth in China, youth who are dropping out of school, who are underperforming in school, and just not on board with the program. And they take them through like months-long program. I mean, really severe stuff. I mean, not violent or abusive necessarily, but very systematic, where the point is this. They're trying to figure out how can we get a different result from our young people. Not how do we just lock them up and throw away the key. How do we get a different result? What do we need to do to get a different result? Our prisons are not places for rehabilitation at all in the U.S. We've completely slashed the education programs. We've slashed all those other programs, skill development programs, that might begin to provide a different vista, a different sense of the horizon for the millions of people that we're locking up. So we're not only locking them up by the millions, but we're saying, while you're in there, we're not even going to try to contribute to any sort of rehabilitative process. It makes no sense. Because people will be released back into the society, and what have we done to try to equip them for success, social success, when they come out? Very little. In fact, we've done just the opposite. We put them in situations and circumstances that are inhumane, that only increase the amount of hostility, antagonism, despair. So we've got to do something about the mass incarceration problem, support every initiative possible that will lean into that situation and bring about some significant reforms. That's number one. And I already mentioned that the job training piece, the job creation piece, the ensuring quality education for all of our young people, ensuring that, whatever it takes. We can't be weary in well-doing. I mean, a lot of people say, well, look, we've thrown a lot of money at these problems and the results have not been promising. So you read reports about Pittsburgh public schools. $18,000 a year spent for a typical Pittsburgh public school student, which is slightly more than the national average for an independent private school student. About $15,000 a year for an independent private school, high school student. And so you say, well, look, we're throwing money at the problem, we're not getting results, so why bother? Well, there is not just the money. There are other issues here. We've got to look at the problems comprehensively. We can't get weary in well-doing. We have no choice. We have to be there for these next generations. Not for a few of them. You know, not just set up a couple of situations where we can point to some successes over here in this corner while the rest of the school population continues to decline. We've got to figure out the problem if we want to take the situation seriously. And not only outside the prisons, but inside the prisons as well. Making sure that we have significant educational and training opportunities. Thirdly, it seems to me we've got to do something about the bleeding, the carnage that is resulting from America's gun culture. We've got all these hostilities, all these separations, all these divisions, all these antagonisms, and on top of that, we're plying everyone with guns. Guns are everywhere. Guns are everywhere in this country. As President Obama said a few weeks ago after the carnage that took place down in Charleston, South Carolina, the U.S. is one of the only advanced industrial countries where we're having this sort of gun carnage in our societies. So something's wrong with the policies. Something's wrong with the practices. Something's wrong with our thinking around gun culture in this society. Of course, there are dangers all around us, and I understand the need for protection, but something's very wrong with a society like ours where so much killing, citizen against citizen, is taking place. This is low-intensity warfare. We may not be a country in active, high-intensity war, but we are a country at war with itself. This is low-intensity warfare taking place in the United States of America. Country at war with itself. And it has to do, the guns aren't the cause, but the guns only exacerbate the level of hostilities and therefore the level of carnage that's taking place in every direction. Not only in our inner city neighborhoods, citizen against citizen, but police against citizens, citizens against police, in every direction. And it's not just terrorists from outside the U.S. Every direction inside our own country, we've got these problems. So we've got significant things we need to address to stop the bleeding, is what I'm saying. And then, if we can, and it's not to say that we don't, at the same time, try to continue to build relationships across the boundaries. But my final statement is this. We're not going to have very much success building relationships across the boundaries if we're not diligent on issues of trying to stop the bleeding. There's a person laying on the side of the road, he's bleeding. Stop, let's do something about the bleeding first. And then contribute every way we can to build relationships across the boundaries. What Westminster's doing, reaching out across the city of Pittsburgh, across Allegheny County, stepping outside the church walls, Bobby and I were talking about. You call that outreach, it's, you know, mission outreach, it's moving outside the church walls, it's moving beyond our boundaries, but not just the boundaries that exist around this institution, but the boundaries that exist around our personal lives, our collective lives, our networks, all sorts of boundaries. Let's figure out how we can move across those boundaries and build authentic relationships. And the authenticity is going to have a lot to do with how well and how effectively we show ourselves ready and able to stop the bleeding. So let me stop there and just invite some conversation. I hope I left plenty of time. I have no idea how long I spoke. 15 minutes. Okay, I'm 15 minutes beyond what I wanted to do. So,
what if we don't do anything of what you're suggesting? Just go on our so-called happy way. We're going to scare.
What if we don't do any of this? Just go on the way we are.
Well, obviously, the implications are not good to the extent that we do that. And to great an extent, that's what we're already doing. That we try to really sort of hide from the issues. And we just can't do that successfully. We're not going to be able to hide. These are worlds that will collide and that are colliding. to the extent that we do not, as a country, rally around some real conception of the common good. It was part of our founding documents. It was part of our founding vision and project. A common good. Problem is that it's been demonstrated by lots of research, Robert Putnam, for one, a Harvard political scientist, has done a lot of work on this particular issue. As he's looked at countries around the world, countries that have greater diversity have a harder time really achieving that sense of commonality, that sense of common purpose, common cause. He looks at some European countries like Scandinavian countries where you don't have that kind of diversity. They're much better at sort of affecting and achieving a common cause, common purpose. But the more diversity that you have, the more difficult it becomes, and precisely because, not only because, but certainly to a great extent because of the antagonisms that exist across those diversities. Diversity is, there's nothing wrong with diversity. But to the extent that people view diversity as a problem, that diversity is somehow taking away from something that is sort of normative and organic and authentic to a context. You bring in diversity and it gets watered down, it gets diluted, it gets affected in some negative way. So to the extent that we think that way about diversity, and it shows up in all sorts of ways, obviously. You know, our immigration policies, lots of policies and practices in our country where we show an inhospitable spirit around diversity issues. We've got to be able to move toward a real embrace of common cause and common purpose in our country and in our world, because the alternatives are disastrous.
So as I listen to what you're saying, I think about the arc of public policy over the last 40 years and a lot of public dialogue about Christian values. And the question that occurs to me is there any room or place or presence of grace in public policy?
Well, I think when you look across the scope of American history, we've had so much grace. We've had so much grace and have squandered so much grace. We emerged out of the disastrous practices of slavery. Could have gone on for a much longer period of time with even greater consequences to the country's trajectory. Took a civil war, but we came out of that, and for a moment, we were on some new footing, reconstruction and so forth, and then that moment of grace, it squandered, and we sort of revert to Jim Crow segregation. We have the civil rights movement, which is a moment of grace. That was pure grace, to have a movement like that congeals around such lofty values and principles. First of all, it was rooted in the Constitution. It was rooted in the Christian conception of brotherhood and sisterhood, of loving one's neighbor. It was rooted in nonviolence. That was grace, to have a leader like Martin Luther King emerge that can embody and articulate that in a way that mobilized the movement. Not that he did it singularly, but he was clearly the face of so much of that. That was grace. We've had moments of grace throughout our history. The election of President Obama, something that few people probably predicted 20 years ago, 10 years ago. That was a moment of grace. We've squandered a lot of that. He squandered some opportunities. So we keep getting grace. Now, how long that holds up, you know, the scripture is The scriptures give us so many illustrations, so much evidence of the fact that God's patience is not absolutely endless. God's patience wore thin, according to scriptural accounts, God's relationship with God's people in various places. Grace was constant, but God's patience did wear thin. And there were implications. President Obama really, as you know, focused on this theme of grace in his eulogy for Reverend Pinckney in Charleston, South Carolina, 3 weeks ago. I thought he misused the word in that particular instance. Because grace has attendant cost. You don't get grace without having to give something. I mean, well, grace is kind of like unmerited, but still, you need to give something in the process. And to say that forgiveness of the person who murdered 9 people was an act of grace, I don't think that was an act of grace. I think that was premature forgiveness, frankly. I think one must ask for forgiveness. One must request forgiveness, which sort of means that you're taking some responsibility. There's accountability involved in that process. So, yeah, so that's one sort of theological way of answering your question. What might be sort of the frontiers of grace from a public policy perspective going forward? I don't know. Hopefully we'll be able to achieve some grace on some of the most vexing issues that I've just talked about here. Income and wealth disparities and inequalities. The grace there is going to require something of us. Mass incarceration, that grace is going to require something of us. Ensuring that we're allocating the kind of resources to education and training, that's going to require some things of us. But if we can take those steps, it seems to me even that would be an act of grace. Because it's not going to come easy. We live in a context where with diversity comes competing interest and often conflicting interest. It's just the nature of society. We don't all have the same interest, same vested interest, the same interest at any level. We have to recognize that fact. And so it's going to require some things of social contract, that whole idea that in order for everybody to get a little something, all of us have to give up a little something. We're not willing to give toward a greater common cause, common purpose, then I don't think that grace is going to happen. Got a couple more.
And the social contract has changed that. You referred to the social contract has changed. You talked about the incarceration and the programs that used to be in the jails and in the prisons that are no longer there, and that's the social contract. Is that many of those programs were at least in part funded, you know, locally, state level, and federally, and all of that funding has gone away. So where do we meet that social contract? How can we affect it? Because the government obviously is not going to start putting money back into places it is taking money out.
It was a very good question, but I think that we can't let the government off the hook. Because the government, we can't simply say as has been said so often, especially since 1996 with the Welfare Reform Act and the charitable choice provision within the Welfare Reform Act, that we're going to look now to the not-for-profit sector to take up all the slack. Well, the non-profit sector doesn't have that kind of resources. The lion's share of the resources are with our governmental structures and institutions. It's the citizens who will ultimately determine what the government does with its authority and with its resources. We as citizens have to insist on policies and practices that conform to the values that we embody. Now, obviously, right now in our country, we are completely divided on most of these issues. We've got to be able to somehow affect the majority around a progressive policy agenda, progressive government spending. They didn't think the civil rights movement would happen. But if we do everything we can, if we just keep doing those things that are within our reach, maybe some escalating things kick in. Maybe some mobilizations happen that surprise us. But I think we just have to stay faithful to the principles that we would want to see our government embody.
Does the media have a responsibility here? And if so, what might that responsibility be?
Does the media have a responsibility here? And if so, what might that responsibility be as it applies to the dynamics of the problem that you're raising?
Well, sure, that's a very important question. And clearly, so much of culture, so much of our worldview is impacted by this enormous power of media.
Yeah.
Enormous power. And it moves in so many directions. And it's been democratized in so many ways that it's not like it can be controlled. I mean, it really is a genie that's sort of out of the bottle, or whatever metaphor you want to use there. So part of it is certainly, as I said in response to the previous question, that citizens, where they are in a position to exert a public influence on institutions, including media institutions, we must do so in ways that help those media institutions to embody and represent our best values and not our worst values. So with the big networks, with those media sources that are under control, the FCC, as citizens, we do need to make sure we're monitoring and doing what we can to exert influence on those public media institutions. With the broader array of democratic discourse that takes place through media, we just have to keep working person by person to try to, and don't concede ground. I mean, so a lot of people in my generation and older who didn't grow up from the crib with internet and all these electronic media technologies, we don't necessarily take as seriously those platforms and venues. We don't necessarily take as seriously the blogospheres and the social media, all those communications platforms that are being utilized with such great effect by younger generation folks, and often in ways that are not constructive to a social vision. We need to claim those spaces too. Get your voice out there. We can't just have church inside the church walls. Even with publishing, I mean, I'm a scholar that's been publishing for years, and we're still using the old snail pace, books and journals, and it takes a couple of years for something to go from pen to the public in many instances, where others could, and I'm doing better now of writing things for blogospheres and electronic internet sources, so I can write it today and it can be to potentially thousands or tens of thousands of people tomorrow. So we've got to do a better job of claiming those spaces as well to get the vision out. The vision that we embody as a generation, as people who are concerned with progressive ideas, as Christian folks, get our vision out there.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, we speak about this a lot in the African-American community. Do you think that we need another Martin Luther King or a national leader? You know, I know Obama's a national leader, but he's an elected official. So, you know, you got to serve
all of the people all of the time, and not all the time are his policies the right policies for us anyway. But we this question comes up all the time, like, is there a lack of a real leader in our community that can help advance some of the causes?
Sure, it's a good question. Now, those kinds of leaders, first of all, are extremely rare. They're something like a miracle. Yesterday was Nelson Mandela Day. And I was watching a documentary on Nelson Mandela this weekend. A person that was a miracle. His role within the context of the transformation of South Africa was a miracle. That kind of leadership comes along rarely and as an act of grace. That's an act of grace. We shouldn't sit around and wait for that kind of leadership to emerge, because that's not going to happen very often. Meanwhile, there are lots of leaders out here. We've got a lot of good people out here doing very good work. Now, do we have a sort of single leader who's able to galvanize around a big, huge, broad agenda in the way that a Mandela or a King or an Obama even were able to do? No, not necessarily. I mean, so no, we may not have a lot of leaders like that, but we've got plenty of good leadership out here. And so, and a lot of that leadership is in you. It's in each and every one of us. We just have to lead where we find ourselves and just bring all that we have within us, all that God has given to us, to the occasion. Because ultimately, it's God who raises up this kind of leadership. And God can choose to do that through an individual on very selective occasions or through a broader constituency. And I think now we've just got to look around and see where the leadership is happening and where we can provide leadership ourselves.
Sadly, I think we are at the end of our time. I wish we had another hour. I know people here, I know there's another hour's worth of questions. And there will probably be another hour at a later time.
Okay, well,
fair enough. We've really enjoyed this and learned a lot. So thank you so much.